Welcome to Today's Issues, offering a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Tim Wildman, President of the American Family Association.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the radio program Today's Issues on AFR, American Family Radio. And as always, we thank you for listening to our network and to our shows here on AFR. Joining me to co-host today is Dr. Ray Pritchard from Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Tim, and how are you today?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Oh, it's bright and sunny, and guess what? It's hot in Texas in the summer, so.
Summertime. What do you got, 96, 95 right in there somewhere?
Yesterday it was 100 with a heat index of 107. So a little warm, but it's Texas in the summer, right?
Exactly. So you're talking straight up 100.
Straight up 100, and you know, as long as it stays below 110, I think we can barely survive, you know, because it can get up pretty hot here. Not like Phoenix. I mean, Phoenix is unbelievable, but still.
But Dallas has humidity and Phoenix doesn't.
That's right. Phoenix has that dry heat, which will fry you and you don't even realize it. But, you know, we're doing good here in Texas. All good.
Dry heat's. I remember being in Phoenix one time, and it was like 110. Some reason this group I was meeting with decided it'd be a great idea to have a meeting in August in Phoenix.
No.
Oh, yeah, they did.
No.
They did. I didn't have a vote on that one.
No.
But I'd never been to Phoenix before, and I didn't really know what to expect. I got out there, and it's like 110 degrees. And they said, well, it's a dry heat.
Oh,
that's what the lady at the hotels told me because I got there at night. So what's this going to be like tomorrow? You know, see, what's dry heat? Not like what you're used to there in the South where it's humid. I said, well, 110 degrees. I don't know how you get by that one. I said, that's dry heat. An oven's dry, isn't it?
Well, you know, you get out in that heat, you don't necessarily sweat as much because the humidity is so low.
Right.
But you can be in real trouble.
Right.
Real trouble because you don't realize what's happening to your body.
Right. You don't sweat as much, therefore you don't feel, quote, as hot, and you don't stay as liquid. Liquidated.
That's right. That's exactly
liquidated
right.
A word? I think it is.
You don't stay. What's the other word? Hydrated.
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 Yeah, I don't think liquidated is a word. Unless
it is
you're going to liquidate your stock or something.
Liquidate your stock. That's right.
Yeah, I don't think it has to do with sweating or anything like that. But, hey, you know, in this world we live in, let's not judge each other.
That's
On our English.
On little things like liquidation.
Liquidated, that's right. All right, coming up on this program today, we got a lot to talk about. Tom Veeley is going to be with us in a few moments. Tom is president of New Beginnings. They are an adoption agency, international. Well, they're actually called New Beginnings International Children and Family Services. We're going to talk to Tom about adoption and other things. And then at the bottom of the hour, what are we going to talk about?
We've got Heather McDonald from the Manhattan Institute. She's written a book, brand new, called The War on Cops, How the New Attack on Law and Order Makes Everyone Less Safe. She's got the facts and figures about how law enforcement is under attack in America. So we'll talk with her about that. And top of the next hour, Stacey Farrell is going to join us. She is a homeschooling mom who's written a book called I'd Rather Be Your Mommy.
You know, the war on cops, that's going to be a very interesting topic and timely to cover. But almost every time, I'm trying to think of an exception, you hear about one of these incidents involving police and where they're accused of using force unnecessarily.
Right.
Or things of that nature. Almost every time, the person that is killed is running from the law.
Right.
You ever notice this?
Right.
And so and then they come back and say, well, the police officer should not have done this. He should not have done that. He should have done this in this situation. And almost all of it is almost an instantaneous decision on the part of a police officer on whether he thinks he might live or die. It's like he's supposed to talk to the person and say, hey, you know, come on, guy.
Would you really shoot me? I mean, or when you're pointing that gun
talk
at
this
me,
out.
Yeah, do you really mean that or not?
Right, I'm going to put you in timeout. You know, if you.
That's right.
I mean, these officers are put in life and death, instantaneous decisions, and then they come back when somebody gets killed, and then the cops got to prove his innocence.
Which is an extremely difficult thing. I was in Chicago 2 weeks ago. And, well, we'll talk to Heather about this, but the situation in Chicago is a mess. I mean, good cops are leaving the force because they feel like they have been proverbially, you know, their hands have been tied. They've been handcuffed by the administration up there. Everybody's looking over their shoulder. So basically what said to me when I was in Chicago, the police just aren't making calls. They, unless they're sure, it's going to be okay. They're letting a lot of stuff pass that they're just not answering every call because it's not
that's
safe.
That's human nature.
Oh, yeah.
That's what's happened in Baltimore, Maryland, too, since is it the district attorney or?
Right. Marilyn Mosby.
Yeah, she's going after those six police officers.
Yeah.
In the Freddie Gray case.
Proven to be a bad mistake on her part.
Three of them have already been found not guilty.
Right, I think her case has collapsed. I don't think
there's going to be... Well, the judge up there, I've been reading about this, the judge is a black man.
Right.
Well, what I'm saying is he's dismissing this. You take the racial equation out of it there.
Right.
It isn't a white judge acquitting white officers. By the way, the officers are three, four of them, I think, are African-American.
Right.
And the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore... And the judge is just dismissing these cases because there's no evidence to support what I'm trying to think, is it the district attorney or the city attorney, Marilyn Mosby?
I'm not sure.
What her title is. Anyway, she's a prosecutor, I think. She's going after these police officers, charging them with manslaughter and things of that nature. And there was just no evidence to ever support that. It's very interesting. What is she? Prosecutor. She's a prosecutor. But it appeared at first where she was going after these police officers just for political reasons. Well, that's what it is.
What it appears to be evidently is what it is. And she came out awful early. And, you know, you want your state's attorney to at least give the appearance of being even-handed. And she was making incendiary comments.
Oh, yeah. I'm doing this for the youth of our city.
That's right.
That's not your job, ma'am. Your job is to law and order, to call them like you see them, not to go after police officers just to make so the people don't burn your town down.
Right.
Anyway, that's going to be – the war on cops is what we're going to talk about at the bottom of the hour. But the what you're talking about in Chicago, what they told you there, is going to happen all over the country. Please – you're going to have good people get out of police work. I'm talking about street work.
Right.
Because they see what's happening to these other police officers where their lives are ruined. That Darren Wilson up in St. Louis?
Right.
Ferguson?
Right.
I think he's in hiding.
Right.
Probably for the rest of his life.
Right. I mean, no, he's not. He can't get a job there.
He won't get a job anywhere.
That's right.
But I don't think. I mean, maybe it'll be hard for him. And
he's going to have to move to some other part of the country, I would think. You know, it's just, it had been terrible.
Right, right, right. And, you know, the idea that that these police officers around the country are going out and looking to pick a fight with people based on their skin color is just, I know there's a few bad apples here and there, probably in any profession, but I tell you what, you know, most police forces now have, you know, try to at least have good representation on their police staff. Anyway, we'll talk to Heather about that. But my point is, if the less quality of people you're able to attract to be a street cop, for example, then when they know that answering a 911, going to confront a druggie on the street that they suspect is doing something, they're not going to do that anymore.
Right.
Because they want to, and then the bad guys are going to know, hey, the cops aren't going to mess with us anymore. Why? Because we'll just accuse them of racism, and their life will be ruined. They don't want that, so they're not going to, they're going to turn their head the other way. That is human nature right there, and that's what's happening, unfortunately, in many places, as you just said, is happening in Chicago, which only makes things more unsafe.
It just makes it worse.
Makes it worse. You're listening to the radio program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. Tim with Ray. We thank you for listening to AFR. Tom Vealey is with us. Good morning, Tom.
Morning, Tim.
How you doing? I'm shaking Tom's hand and welcoming him to our program. He's been on several times before. Tom is the president of New Beginnings, which you describe as an inter- – you don't. Well, your organization does. New Beginnings is an international children's and family services ministry, right?
Yes, we're located here in Tupelo, and we provide domestic and international adoption services and have for about 30 years.
30 years? How long have you been there?
14.
What got you involved in this work?
Oh, my wife and I adopted internationally in 1982 and 1985.
From where?
Korea, South Korea.
Both children?
Both children, both girls.
And how much does that cost, if I can be personal?
Oh, back then?
Yeah.
Back then it was about $9,000 or $10,000, and there were no tax credits or
per child?
Grants or anything like that, yeah, per child.
Okay, does that include your travel and all that?
We didn't have to travel.
You didn't?
We didn't have to travel back then. They escorted.
But you have to today, don't you?
You have to travel generally overseas today. Yeah.
How did you get your child if you didn't have to travel?
They were escorted over by members of the agency, the international agency. We paid some of the airfare, and that's how they transported. That's how they got some of their staff back and forth between
through
countries.
The ministry that you lead now.
No,
a different one.
Right, that was actually through Holt in Eugene, Oregon.
Well, what I'm hearing that it's cost prohibitive for a lot of people today to adopt. Is that true?
It's expensive. But I don't think it's as cost prohibitive as it was in 82 and 85. If you do the adjustment on the dollars.
Oh, really?
The cost for that 9 or 10 would be around 30, 35
today. How many countries
today.
Do you guys represent?
We do three active programs in three countries. We have one in Taiwan, which is a partnership. And then we have Poland and China.
Which one do you bring the most children to America?
It's been Poland. China will be picking up because we're new in China. We were one of the first to get a license in China over the last, I think, 12 or 13 years.
What kind of folks come to you? I mean, are you a particular denomination, or do you take people who are just Christian? You want to place these children in Christian homes, right?
Right. New Beginnings works with Christian families of all denominations that would come to us. We have a statement of faith that's
okay, as long as those parents subscribe to your statement of faith,
they can adopt through New Beginnings.
They can adopt through New Beginnings.
Right. Now, we also do home studies for a lot of other agencies. So there may be an agency in Oregon or Washington or California or somewhere that a family's working with, generally because they want to work with a different country. You know, it could be any country, Bulgaria or one of the other countries in Eastern Europe, South America, Central America. And in those cases, a family living in Mississippi, also we're licensed in Tennessee, we would do the home studies for those families on behalf of the other agency. So in those cases, they don't have to sign our statement of faith when we're doing just the home study.
How do people get in touch with you?
Generally, the website, which is www.newbeginningsadoptions.org, or our phone number is 662-842-6752.
What's the website again?
NewBeginningsAdoptions.org.
Okay. I invited you to come on and talk about something else too here. We had a visitor here a few weeks ago from another country who was doing a documentary, right? News documentary. You know what I'm talking about?
The news documentary from, not another country.
They were here in Mississippi to talk about our religious freedom issue.
Yes.
And they interviewed you.
They interviewed.
Mississippi passed a religious freedom law.
Yes.
In the last couple of months.
HB 1523.
Which the liberal news media has attacked the state for, and the governor, Governor Phil Bryant, and people and other liberal media services from around the world. They, you know, these are a bunch of backwoods, redneck, Yahoo bigots who just want to persecute gay people. And that's the presentation that the media makes about.
Yeah, that's how the final video came out looking that way. It was an interesting thing, Tim.
I wanted you to tell about that experience because
they
interviewed
it.
You. We didn't grant it. I forgot what the name of the network was. We wouldn't grant them an interview because we kind of knew what they were doing, you know, what their approach was, what their angle was going to be. But you decided to talk to them.
Yeah, you did a little more background than I found out at the morning of and decided to go ahead with it. So we did the interview.
Yeah.
Along with another gentleman in Jackson that's been doing a lot of our communication down there with
Vice News Production, that was the name of it, and I forgot what country they were in, but
they're from the States.
Oh, they are? Okay,
yeah.
My apologies.
Yeah, they're from the
okay.
States, and so they came out with the video.
Okay,
and showed
so they interviewed
it.
We wouldn't do an interview with them. They wanted to interview you because you're a Christian ministry too.
Yeah, but we didn't get in the final product. And my friend down in Jackson that helped us do a lot of the PR work for us on this topic, he was interviewed and he didn't make it on there either.
Well, they want to interview you about the religious freedom law, though. How did that have to do with adoption?
Well, they're looking at is New Beginnings under the HB 1523.
That's the law, the religious freedom law.
If it goes into effect, New Beginnings can then stand behind our long-held religious beliefs, which in our statement of faith, I don't have it here with me, but it's generic. It's, you know, we believe the Bible is the Word of God. We believe that salvation is through Jesus Christ. We believe that Jesus is coming again. And we believe marriage is between one man and one woman.
You want to play, so you're going to only place children in those kinds of the environment that fits with your mission statement.
That's correct.
And you want to maintain that.
Yes.
Integrity of your ministry.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And so the Vice News folks came, and of course, the first question they had was, why doesn't the First Amendment protect us? And that probably is a good question. Why doesn't it protect us? I'll let you cover that on one of your programs. But that's what HB 1523 was doing. And as I understand it, HB 1523, part of it came about because when there was one of the previous rulings in the Supreme Court, the lawyers for the government said, hey, you know, the states can make some laws to define what this is. And so our state did exactly they were told to
You're talking about the Obergefell or the decision by the United States Supreme Court where they said that same-sex marriage is allowed in America, can't be prohibited altogether. But they did say that states can make their own laws on how exactly to deal with this. They just can't prohibit it, but they can make it, they can make a exception. They can make laws that you know, allow for religious freedom.
Right, protect persons of faith, which goes back to the founding of our country and
in
Jefferson's thinking.
Do you think in other states that Christian adoption agencies are going to be forced to give children to same-sex couples?
Well, in some states, they already are. Some states...
Forced by law?
Yeah.
Where is that? In California or where?
California is one of those. They're required to by licensure. You know, there's a practical aspect of it, and that's what I told the folks from Vice News when we did it. The practical side of it, that from a very professional side, is that the birth mothers we work with choose the adoptive families. And the example I gave them, which didn't end up on the news, was that over in my 14 years at New Beginnings, I've had five young ladies who I self-identified as being lesbians, who came to us
five in how long?
In 14 years.
Okay.
Yeah, they came to us that wanted a heterosexual couple to adopt. That's why they came to us. And during that same period of time, we haven't had any young ladies that have come to us asking for a same-sex couple.
You mean they're a lesbian who comes to you and says, I want a baby?
No, they're going to be placing a baby for adoption.
Oh, they're going to be so you have a lesbian, well, they're not altogether lesbian, but they wouldn't be pregnant, right?
Correct.
So they're bisexual, whatever, and so they've said, but I want to put my baby up for adoption by a heterosexual couple. That's what you've encountered.
Correct. That's what I've encountered.
Okay.
We haven't had
the reverse.
Any of the reverse. So, you know, at this point with HB 1523, of course, it protects us. If HB 1523 is not in place, the birth mother will still have a right to determine the placement of a child. So when you get the girls come in who generally here in our area are very have conservative backgrounds, they would be willing to work with us. You know, if we had a girl that came in that wanted to place, was adamant about placing with a same-sex couple, then we would refer to agencies across the country that we know do those placements. Right. We can accommodate that. So
that maintains your integrity, though.
Yes. Yep.
As a Christian ministry. You're listening to the radio program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. I'm Tim Wildman. Dr. Ray Pritchard co-hosting with me. In studio is Tom Beeley. Tom is president of New Beginnings. They are international adoption and family services agency. They're based out of Tupelo. That's in Mississippi, which is where we are, but they do work across the country. And they help people who want to adopt from the countries of China and Poland and what other countries?
Taiwan.
Taiwan. And how many babies a year do you guys?
We placed 19 domestic last year, and I believe about 35 internationally.
What age group do you go up to? What age can you adopt to? 2, 3?
Oh, for the children? We placed last year children, I believe, up into the 8, 9, 10-year-old range.
How do you handle the emotional side of this? Because I would imagine there's a lot of emotion, not only joy, but don't you have situations where adoptions don't go through and the parents are devastated?
Yeah, I look back to one of my friends that her name is Danita, and she described it this way. She said, I feel like I'm on a roller coaster. I go in a room with a birth mother who even when she's made a good adoption plan and placing for adoption, there's still a lot of emotion when she's placing her baby for adoption. And she says, I'm passing out Kleenex in one room, and I go out in the hallway with the adoptive family, and they're all excited, and they have balloons. So it's this up and down. Our workers who work directly with the birth mothers, I would say, have one of the most emotional jobs that a person could possibly have. The back and forth, the day-to-day, they're heroes. They're working with birth mothers who are, some of them are rape situations. Some of them are just consensual sex situations. But whatever that may be, they're working with a young lady who's making a decision that she believes is the best for that child in placing a child for adoption. The girls we work with have chosen that abortion is not the answer, that parenting is not going to work for them generally, and so they choose adoption. And they work through it for many weeks or months in advance. This isn't, we rarely get the girl that walks in the front door and says, oh, here's my baby, I want a place for adoption, I decided this today. It's a long, thought-out process that we work with them on, do a lot of counseling on.
How do you feel about, maybe I shouldn't ask you this question in your role. If you don't want to answer, that's okay. How do you think about, how do you handle the birth parent, the birth mother who says, I want to see my child later on in a year or two? Because don't most parents who adopt don't want that kind of situation?
It's very common now. 14 years ago when I started at New Beginnings, the closed adoption, as they call it, which was without contact between the birth mother and the adoptive family, was much more common and prevalent. Now it is pretty much most of the time open adoption, or we would call semi-open adoption. Most birth mothers today want to meet the adoptive couple. Some of them want to maintain contact over time. And what we do is work with the birth mothers in advance and the adoptive families in advance, knowing what both want, and we match them that way.
So if they're both consensual with that, then it can be a positive.
It can be a very positive, but it is consensual, yes.
Yeah, you have to have that.
Correct.
What is a website to get in touch with you and your phone number?
www.newbeginningsadoptions.org and 662-842-6752.
If somebody's interested in adopting through your agency, can they just call you?
Absolutely.
662-842-6752. Our New Beginnings with an S, adoptions with an S .org. Hey, Tom, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Tim.
Keep
appreciate
up the good work.
Appreciate all you do.
What you're doing is pro-life.
Yes.
You're doing pro-life work. Yep. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us.
Next time on Today's Issues, we'll talk with Reese Stenner, author of If in Doubt, answering the seven great questions about faith.
So many of us have questions about, you know, did God make the world? Is there a right or wrong? Is there a true foundation? Is the Bible reliable? Where is all this going?
And Dr. Alex McFarland will cover question 16 of the 21 toughest questions your kids may ask about Christianity. That's on the next Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on AFR.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. One of the places we'll visit on our spiritual heritage tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon is the United States Marine Corps Memorial, also known as the Iwo Jima Memorial, built in 1954 and the largest bronze statue in the world. Stephen McDowell, who's the president of the Providence Foundation, a historian, will join us all along the way, answer questions, talk about the people, the places, and the events in our nation's capital, and then on to Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington. In addition, we'll go to Colonial Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown for those who want to join us for this separate trip, which just precedes the Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon tour. For all the information on either of these tours, just visit us on the website, spiritualheritagetours.com. Again, this is in September. Go to the website, spiritualheritagetours.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with this Fox News and commentary next. I watched 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, a few days ago, and I watched it again last night. It's the story of the terrorist attack on our consulate in Benghazi, the story of what really happened. It's a film every American of voting age should watch before casting their ballot in November. Today, the Republicans released their final report on Benghazi, blamed by the Obama administration on a YouTube video, but we now know that was a lie. In private, the White House knew it was the work of al-Qaeda. Americans were under siege. They needed help, but help never came. In the end, Ambassador Chris Stevens, Foreign Service worker Sean Smith, and former Navy SEALs Ty Woods and Glenn Dougherty were killed. Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, asked the question, what difference does it make? I suspect the families of the fallen would be more than willing to provide the answer. I'm Todd Stearns.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the radio program, Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. The program's called Today's Issues on AFR. I'm Tim Wildman with Dr. Ray Pritchard. Ray is co-hosting with me today, as he does most Tuesdays and Thursdays. Ray, if people want to connect with us on the internet, how can they do that?
Well, the very best way to do it is get the AFR app.
Right.
In the iTunes store, or we've got it for Android. And when you have the AFR app, which is free, by the way, it doesn't matter where you go.
Right.
If you have wireless, whether you're in South America, Asia, Africa, around the world, you can listen to AFR streaming live right to your smartphone or to your laptop or your iPad 24 hours a day.
All right. I'm trying to find out, too. We just put our station in Culpeper, Virginia. Just went out, and we just increased the signal coverage. And so we're reaching all up into Northern Virginia, the Washington, D.C. suburbs.
So we're finally on.
Yes, sir. Praise the Lord.
Well, thank God. It has taken.
Yes, we thought the Lord was going to come back before we got this mission accomplished, but which would have been fine, too. But what it is, we bought a station a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, whenever it was, that was to reach into Washington, D.C. area, Northern Virginia, and we just finally got that thing turned on. We had to go through a lot of red tape and bureaucratic business, but we just got it turned on. I'm trying to get the place on the dial where we are, but we go all up to Dulles Airport.
Wow.
Signal gets a little sketchy there in Arlington and Alexandria, but we're going to get a booster or a repeater that will help us cover all of the D.C. area.
Oh, fantastic.
With our signal. But we're reaching a lot of new people now who are listening in Northern Virginia. I'm going to get the place on the dial so that you can call your friends and family who live in the area. It's WARN 91.3. But if you have friends that live in the Northern Virginia suburbs of D.C., and they want to listen to American Family Radio, they can do that at on 91.3 FM on the dial there, 91.3 FM on the dial. And that's just one of the newer stations we've added, Huntsville, Alabama, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I'm thinking in the last few months. We've got
Are we on yet in New Orleans or still?
No,
still
New Orleans come. And Jacksonville, Florida are next.
Wow.
And Corpus Christi, too.
Fantastic.
So we're going to be on in Corpus Christi. So those are new places for American Family Radio, and we'll let you know when we're on the air there. So because if you have friends or family who live in those areas, you can tell them that American Family Radio is coming to their town soon. You know, Jacksonville, I don't know, that's probably 1.5 million people.
Oh, it is. Huh? I mean, that's one of the fastest growing metropolitan areas in the United States. Beautiful part of the country. And so that's next. That in New Orleans coming up, two major metropolitan areas. And hello, Northern Virginia, and hello,
exactly.
Washington, D.C. It's fantastic.
Exactly. 91.3 is where we're on the air in Northern Virginia right now. Culpeper, I think our tower's near Culpeper. You go north there. So we're adding, a million plus people that, a couple million probably, that have access to the radio station now over the air, 91.3, and in the Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area. You're listening to the radio program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. We're going to interview our guest about the war on cops momentarily. You and I haven't talked about this. What do you think about Britain leaving the European Union?
You know, I think it's a great step for our friends in England to regain their national sovereignty. I think that's probably the number one issue. I mean, obviously, immigration played into that, Tim, but I think the voters in England, now it was a close vote, it was 52 to 48.
Yes, it was.
So it wasn't like 60-40, but by a million point, 1.4 million vote margin, they voted to leave the European Union, which the fun part is seeing the shock on the faces of all the aristocrats, right, and the academics and all the pundits who said they will never leave. I think there is at the heart of the British people, they understood that they were losing their culture to the European Union and to the folks in Brussels who increasingly want to make Europe into a mega state, a mega nation, if you will. So I thought the Brexit vote was hugely, hugely significant, and it has shaken up the political calculus on the other side of the pond.
Yeah, I want to talk more about to you about that later, but right now Heather McDonald is with us. She is author of the book we told you about earlier called The War on Cops, How the New Attack on Law and Order Makes Everyone Less Safe. And it's published by Encounter Books and is available everywhere books are sold now, in brick and mortar stores or on the internet. Heather, good morning and welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I greatly appreciate it.
I'm Tim with Ray here. Give us an overview of your book, The War on Cops.
Well, the book rebuts the Black Lives Matter narrative that the police are racist killers of blacks. It gives data on police shootings that show that, in fact, police officers kill a greater percentage of white and Hispanic homicide victims than black homicide victims. 12% of all white and Hispanic homicide victims are killed by the police, as opposed to only 4% of black homicide victims. It gives facts about policing, and it also gives voice to the many law-abiding residents of inner-city communities who beg for police presence. I was the first to notice nationally what I've called the Ferguson effect, which is the phenomenon of officers backing off of discretionary proactive policing under the onslaught of hostility and hatred that's been directed at them by the Black Lives Matter activists and their enablers in the media and the White House. And when officers back off, crime is shooting through the roof, which is what we're seeing in today's big cities with large black populations. So the book also goes into a lot of detail explaining the Ferguson effect and documenting what the lives that have been taken as crime seems to be reversing the 20-year crime drop that we've enjoyed.
Heather, you've got a chapter in the book called Depolicing New York. Well, there was a time under Mayor Giuliani and perhaps under Bloomberg as well when it was a relatively safe major city, but that has changed. Who's behind the change, and what's been the result of the depolicing of America's largest city?
Well, last year we had a 17% increase in the 56 largest cities, which accounts for most of the urban population. A 17% increase in homicides in 1 year is nearly unprecedented. That is a massive increase. But the increase was even greater in the cities dominated by black populations. There you had homicide increases from 54% in Washington, D.C. to 90% in Cleveland. And officers continue to be surrounded every time they get out of their car, it seems, in high-crime areas with hostile jeering crowds, throwing things, interfering with their lawful authority, sticking cell phones right in an officer's face as he's trying to make an arrest or conduct an investigation. And that type of virulence has to affect officers. They're human. And when they're encountering that type of resistance on the street, coupled with a incessant claim that things like stop, question, and frisk or low-level public order offenses enforcement, known as broken windows policing, is racist, the cops are going to get that message. Policing is political. And if a very powerful segment of the political establishment, which is the media and politicians, keep telling the cops that they're racist for trying to save lives in minority communities by engaging in proactive policing, at some point the cops are going to do less of it. And that's what's going on right now.
You know, you used an interesting phrase, and I don't know if I can say it exactly correctly, but discretionary stops. What's an example of the kind of discretionary stop that maybe 5 years ago they were making, that maybe now under this incredible barrage of criticism, what's an example of a kind of call they're not responding to or stop they're not making simply because of the unfair criticism that they're under? How would it manifest itself?
Well, cops are definitely responding to 911 calls. That's after there's already been a victim. You know, somebody's been robbed and he calls 911. Cops are rushing there to try and give solace and get the details. But what brings crime down is the proactive discretionary policing between those 911 calls. And that's the question of an officer seeing somebody hanging out on a known drug corner at 1 a.m., hitching up his waistband as if he has a gun. A cop doesn't have to do anything about that. There's no crime victim. There's no probable cause to make an arrest yet. But he does have the legal authority under the Constitution to make what's known as a Terry stop. And that's getting out of his car, asking a few questions if he has reasonable suspicion that there may be a crime underway or a crime being planned. He can't take that person under custody, under arrest, but he can ask a few questions. And if he thinks the person may be armed, frisk him. And those types of discretionary activities are precisely what's been in the crosshairs of the ACLU, which inevitably accuses cops of racial profiling if the data on those types of Terry stops do not match population benchmarks. I'll give you an example of that in New York City, where we had a 10 years of litigation against the New York Police Department for its stop, question, and frisk activity. In New York City, blacks are 23% of the population, and they constituted about 53% of all Terry stops or stop, question, and frisk that the NYPD, the New York Police Department, made. So the ACLU or the Obama Justice Department gets its hands on that disparity between population, 23%, and police activity, 53%, and says, aha, the NYPD is racist. You know, question answered, case closed. What they inevitably leave out of that calculus is that though blacks are 23% of the New York City population, they commit nearly 80% of all shootings and 70% of all robberies. How do we know that? The victims of and witnesses to those crimes tell the police. They are overwhelmingly minorities themselves, but that's who they report is doing the violent crime in New York City. Whites, by contrast, are 34% of New York City's population. They commit less than 2% of all shootings and 4% of all robberies. So that means that every time, and if you add Hispanic shootings to black shootings, you get 98% of all shootings in New York City. Those disparities are repeated in every single big city in America today. The face of violent crime, sadly, is overwhelmingly black and brown. And it means that every time the police are going to a neighborhood plagued by gang violence and retaliatory drive-by shootings, they're going to minority neighborhoods called to look out for minority suspects and trying to protect minority victims. And they will make pedestrian stops. They will make those Terry stops to try and interrupt retaliatory shootings. And they will be generating precisely the type of racially disproportionate stop, question, and frisk data that the ACLU and the Obama Justice Department will use against them in the next racial profiling lawsuit.
Talking to Heather McDonald. Heather, tell us the title of your book and where people can get it.
It's The War on Cops, and as you say, it's available wherever books are sold today, in bookstores and certainly on the web.
This kind of started with the Michael Brown case. This kind of became big news, what, a couple of years ago in Ferguson, Missouri, with the Michael Brown?
Right.
And Darren Wilson situation?
August 2014, Michael Brown shooting, the hands up, don't shoot hoax.
Yeah, but the hands up, don't shoot never happened, right?
It was thoroughly discredited by the Obama Justice Department itself. It was a lie, and the people in that community of Ferguson around Florissant Avenue who saw the shooting and who saw that Darren Wilson was engaged in self-defense were terrified to testify. They barricaded themselves in their apartments behind sofas because they didn't want to be called to the grand jury because they would be so retaliated against by the Brown sort of cronies in that community.
Well, you remember his friend who was with him, Michael Brown, talking about, he was the young man who was shot and killed by Darren Wilson, the police officer. By the way, which I want to talk to you more. I'd like to ask you a question about the quote unarmed end quote, which is always used after the fact when they find out that the man doesn't have a gun or a knife. But I want to ask you about that for just a minute. It was a young man. I don't want to get too bogged down in this one particular case, but this kind of set the country on fire. You remember when his friend who was with him, when Darren Wilson told him to quit walking in the middle of the street, get on the sidewalk, and then his friend was there when Michael Brown was shot, said that he got shot in the back, right?
Right.
He was walking away, and he said he shot him like an animal. Well, the autopsy proved that wasn't the case at all. He was shot in the front, in front of his body. And then after, you know, putting his hands inside the police officer's car, wrestling for a gun, that was what was proven later in the investigation. But my point was, it was that young man who was with him who lied about the situation. It caused all the people to believe him that this Michael Brown was gunned down in cold blood. And so, I mean, if a guy's gunned down by a cop in cold blood like that, yeah, it would make you know what I'm saying? It would inflame a community or a situation. But the whole thing was based on a lie from the very beginning. And nobody ever held that guy who lied about it to the cops, to the world, to account that I know of.
Not only has he never been held to account, but the Michael Brown martyrdom continues. I mean, I thought after the Justice Department so thoroughly shredded the hands up, don't shoot.
And this was the Obama Justice Department who's saying none of that ever happened. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But it was one section of the Obama Justice Department that works most closely with law enforcement. Very different from the civil rights section of the Obama Justice Department, which is the one that goes around suing police departments. But nevertheless, it was the Obama Justice Department. But Eric Holder tried to completely suppress that side of the report by saying, well, it was just the high standard of proof for civil rights lawsuits that prevented us from bringing a civil rights lawsuit based on the Michael Brown death. That was complete massaging the truth, because in fact, under no standard of proof would Darren Wilson be found liable for civil rights violations or any kind of criminal charges. But anyway, I did think naively that after that Justice Department report came out, completely vindicating the abused St. Louis County Attorney, right, Robert McCulloch, and the decision of the grand jury not to indict Officer Darren Wilson, I thought Michael Brown would be quietly shelved and we would move on to the next Black Lives Matter martyr. Instead, he continues to be invoked by the mainstream media and certainly the activists as part of this phony war on black people that cops are conducting.
Yeah, and then the St. Louis Rams football players coming out before a game, holding their hands up, saying, hands up, don't shoot. Continuing the narrative among the black community that Michael Brown was gunned down in cold blood while he's holding his hands up, running away from the cops, from the police officer. I mean, I guess it's one thing to have something actually happen that you get angry about, but when you get angry about something that didn't even happen, you know what I'm saying? It just makes people who are fair-minded go, you know, if you're going to get angry and burn a town down, at least do something. At least have it about something that really happened, you know, not some phony, bogus story. You're listening to what about the situation in Baltimore now, where the city prosecutor is going after six police officers, black and white, in the Freddie Gray case? Three of them have been acquitted already, haven't they?
Well, the first was a hung jury, but I don't know, you know, if that case is going anywhere. But yes, the other two. Officer Edward Nero, Judge Williams, that was a bench trial. He acquitted him, and most recently, Judge Williams also acquitted Officer Caesar Goodson, the driver of the van, of all the charges against him. To me, the Baltimore prosecution is the spawn of the Black Lives Matter movement. It is the very symbol of the conceit that police are racist murderers. That's what drove Marilyn Mosby to declare these completely unjustified charges against the officers for what was a accidental death. You know, it's still mysterious when exactly the injury occurred and how it happened, but
they burned the town down.
They destroyed the livelihood of many, many people there who were just trying to provide services to the community. And the media engages in what I call riot porn. They love it when there's black violence, because it vindicates their view that we remain a racist society. And there was really no real penalties there either.
I have one other question. I know Ray does. We've got about six or seven minutes maybe left here on the program. Why the high rate of crime by African-American males aged 15 to 25? Why is that?
I think it's family breakdown. You know, there's liberal root causes and conservative root causes. The liberal root causes are poverty, racism, income inequality. And, as you know, in name of those root causes, we've had trillions of government spending in the last 40 years trying to alleviate poverty and the resulting, what the liberals claim is the resulting crime. I would say that if I had to name my root cause, it would be family breakdown, and the fact that now you have nationwide an out-of-wedlock birth rate of blacks of 73%, and in places like Southside Chicago or Mott Haven in the Bronx here in New York, it's 80-85%. And kids need their fathers. Children need fathers. They need fathers and mothers. The social science is absolutely clear that children raised in single-parent homes face a huge, huge higher chance of becoming juvenile delinquents themselves and ending up in prison as adults. But it's very hard to talk about that now. We've got the feminists who are saying that strong women can do it all, and they're trying to marginalize men. And now gay marriage makes it even harder to talk about the all importance of the biological two-parent family, because that's seen as dissing the lesbian parents. So it's an uphill battle, but unless we can find the courage to say that children need mothers and fathers, I think that policing is going to remain the second best solution to maintaining order in these anarchic communities.
We're talking with Heather McDonald. She's the author of The War on Cops: How the New Attack on Law and Order Makes Everyone Less Safe, just out from Encounter Books. And this is, I think, the most up-to-date coverage of the war on cops, the most up-to-date that you can find in print at the moment. You've got a chapter called, that's a question, so I just want to throw this to you. Is the criminal justice system racist? That's the accusation made by the Black Lives Matter folks. What's your answer?
It is not, and it's not just Black Lives Matter activists who are making that accusation, unfortunately, Ray. It's also President Obama, who seems to take every opportunity to say that the reason that young black males are in prison at such high rates is because the criminal justice system treats them differently, and we've got a racist war on drugs. In fact, criminologists have been trying to prove that racial disparity for decades, and they always come up short. The honest ones are forced to conclude that the overrepresentation of blacks in prison is due to their astronomically higher violent crime rates. Blacks commit homicide at 8 times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. Black males commit gun homicide, young black males at 10 times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. And the black incarceration rate is also not the effect of the war on drugs. And the war on drugs was instigated by law-abiding black citizens who wanted a response to the crack epidemic and before that the heroin epidemic. If you took all drug prisoners out of the prison population, the percentage of black prisoners would go down from 37.4% to 37.2%. In other words, the drug prisoners has absolutely nothing to do with blacks' disproportionate rates of incarceration. It's driven by violent crime and property crime.
So the net effect is that our country, especially in the big cities, is going to get more dangerous because cops don't want to have their lives ruined in one episode of pulling over somebody. They'd rather just turn their head the other way and let them go on by.
Right. They'll wait for the next radio call. That's the type of reactive policing that we had through the early 1990s that was turned on its head in 94 in New York City under Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, that started saying we are going to prevent crime, the police, not just react to it, and we will do that by being proactive. That is now what officers are reluctant to engage in inner cities, and that's what I call the Ferguson effect. And unless we turn this discourse around, I think it's going to get worse.
Yeah. Well, it's already showing up in Baltimore.
Chicago is the prime example.
And Chicago. Thank you, Heather. Appreciate you being on with us. Very interesting topic. The book is called The War on Cops: How the New Attack on Law and Order Makes Everyone Less Safe, by Heather McDonald, who's been our guest this half hour. My thanks to Ray. We'll be back after the news. Ray will stay with me after the news. We'll be back with more of today's issues on the American Family Radio Network.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.